So we're in beginning chapter 9, and in last verse in chapter 8, verse 35, there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers who were living among them. Who might some of those strangers have been that were living among the Israelites at this time? Carolee?
People that they had captured?
Okay. I'm not sure that they've captured anybody, but those definitely would be the... Ted, you wanted to add something to that?
We have at least Rahab.
Yep.
And her family.
Yeah, she wasn't captured, though.
No.
She gave herself freely. But, I might be getting ahead of myself. And, I'm trying to remember who came into the group just recently. Dane, help me out here.
Who came into the group just recently?
They live on the outskirts of the Israelites. They're not allowed to be among them.
You mean the Gibeonites?
The Gibeonites.
Are they the ones that fooled the Israelites?
Well, we're not there yet, though.
We're not there.
No, we're not there yet.
What are you talking about?
I guess I must have had a dream.
Remember when they left Egypt, that there were a number of, I guess you call them hangers-on, that left Egypt with them. Now, it's been 40 years. I don't know if they're still around, but at least some of those people from Egypt were still associated with them.
Yeah, I believe that I'm thinking of the Gibeonites, but for some reason or other, I'm thinking a chapter or two behind myself, and that those events took place then. But naturally, we haven't studied the Gibeonites yet, so they're not among the Israelites at this time.
My heading on my phone here says Guile of the Gibeonites at the top of that chapter.
Yeah, okay. And that's what we're going to study tonight. And so I might as well just quit babbling, and we'll go right ahead and read the first two verses of this. And Ron, newcomer, would you read the first two verses of chapter 9 for us, please?
And it came to pass, when all the kings which were on this side of Jordan in the hills and in the valleys, and in all the coasts of the great sea, over against Lebanon, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard thereof, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and the Israelite, and with Israel with one accord.
Okay, thank you. So what did the kings of Canaan land prepare to do, or propose to do?
Fight,
yeah. They decided that they would fight with one accord. And there's a footnote in my Bible that with one accord actually means literally with one mouth. And that sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? But if you think about it, unity comes when everyone's speaking the same thing, isn't it? And we are to be unified. We're encouraged to be unified. So the kings of Canaan land, they heard it. What did they hear? Carol?
They heard that God was with them and wiped out cities. And if they were going to stand against this army, in the thinking of men, they were going to have to join together to stand united, because otherwise they were going to fail.
They did that. They What did they hear? They heard immediately, the last thing they heard was the conquest of Ai, wasn't it? Word gets around because people were mobile even back then. They didn't have the media that we have, but things spread word of mouth. There was trade between everybody, and so that's how news would naturally get around. So, in connection with this, and with the fact that the kings want to get together and take on the Israelites, I found a passage in Psalms 83. This is written in a time of David, but it sheds a little light onto what we're talking about tonight. It reads, "Thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head." So they've taken notice. "They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against the hidden ones. They have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance." So the Israelites, everyone wants to do away with them because they are a force to be reckoned with. In Joshua, in chapter 3, in verse 9, "Come here and hear the words of Jehovah your God. By this you shall know that the living God is among you." What better reason would there possibly be for the Canaanite nations? Well, they're not actually nations. They're more like city-states. But for them to fear the Israelites. They heard about the Israelites crossing Jordan on dry ground. So the Israelites' God is an awesome God.
This is a really good illustration of a principle that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. These city-states fought with each other all the time. And so suddenly now they banded together because they have a common enemy, which is Israel. But the fact that they banded together is just proof of the fact that adversity makes strange bedfellows. Sometimes we band together just to fight a common enemy, even though we don't like each other.
Yes, indeed. I like that phrase, "the enemy of my enemy is my friend." And I think about Second World War. I wasn't even born. Well, I was born in the Second World War, 1944. But back at that time, a lot of nations were banding together to fight the evil that was upon them. And we didn't all necessarily get along in peacetime. But when there was something that challenged peace, they were able to band together. So in question two, how did the Gibeonites respond? And I selected verses 3-5 to answer that question. And Jane, would you read those for us, please?
When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took with worn-out sacks on their donkeys, wine sacks, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet, and worn out clothes on themselves. And all the bread of their provisions was dried and had become crumbled.
Thank you very much. So how did the Gibeonites respond? What's the first thing that we encounter there in that reading?
They acted craftily.
Yeah. They were sneaky. They came up with a plan. They disguised themselves, didn't they? As Jane read, they wore worn-out clothes, sandals. They had old sacks and wineskins, old dry bread. And why did they do that? Why did they say they did that? Maybe we didn't read quite far enough to get that. But if you read the text before class, Bill...
Deception.
Deception, okay. They lied.
To give the appearance that they'd come far.
Yeah. Carol?
I don't know how much they knew or how they would know, but the first two cities are totally destroyed as far as all of the people. So they know that Israel is not taking anybody prisoner. And unlike the other people who decided to fight, they said, okay, well, the only way we can do anything is to try and save our own necks by making a false treaty or a treaty with them.
Yeah. Yep. But they know because, in reality, they are not so far away, are they? They say, they lied. They say, we have come from a far country. So what? What difference does that make to Joshua? Excuse me?
They have no bread, nothing to eat.
Right, okay.
For somebody to give them a handout.
Okay. Ted, can you add something?
Well, I would say that they would probably have some idea about the Israelites' law and that how they had to treat sojourners, how they had to treat people who came into the camp of Israel as strangers.
Okay.
Because that law was readily available for all to see how Israel treated people who came into their camp who were strangers, visiting, coming through. They didn't just kill them. They treated them with respect.
Yeah, and even today in our New Testament, we're encouraged to treat strangers with good hospitality because they might be angels. You never know. Dean?
Well, remember, there had been the commandment given that when I give you the land of Canaan, you make no treaty with the people in that land. So their purpose is to say, well, we're not from here. We've come from a long, long way away. So you could make a treaty with us. Because we're not in the list of people that God had said, don't make a treaty with, even though in reality they were.
Right.
So they're trying to get around this provision.
So it's the difference between a near country or and a far country, isn't it? Because when, if you'll remember, in Deuteronomy, I think it was 20, we found out that when Israel came into Canaan land, that's their land, they were to annihilate every living thing in that land. Sometimes not the animals, but always the people, because they were a bad influence. They would teach the Israelites to sin against God. So just like Dean said, if they were a far country, they wouldn't be in their country. They wouldn't be in their land. So they would be in a different land, and they weren't. They wouldn't be under the ban. Is the word that applies to the people that are currently living in Canaan land. They're also called near countries or near cities, and the Israelites were to destroy everything that's under the ban. So that is a commandment from God. So it is a big deal when they say we've come from a far country because they know, somehow they know, that the Israelites are exterminating anyone that's in a close country. So question number three, how did the men of Israel react to the Gibeonites' proposition or response? Is maybe a better word, but the two words are very similar. Bill, would you read us verses 6 and 7, please, of chapter 9?
And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto them, and to the men of Israel, we are come from a far country, now therefore make ye a covenant with us. The men of Israel said unto the Hivites, peradventure ye dwell among us, how shall we make a covenant with you?
Okay, thank you. So, how did the men of Israel react to the Gibeonites?
Well, first they asked a smart question. They didn't follow through on it.
Okay, yeah, they did. They were giving some of that hospitality that Ted was talking about. They didn't just kill them outright. So the Gibeonites said, "We have come from a far country." That's a lie. "Therefore, make a covenant with us." On the face of it, it doesn't make sense that they would just come and they're from a far country, so come on, make this agreement with us. But the Israelites, specifically, it says the they went to Joshua. But then the men of Israel respond by saying, "Perhaps you are living among us or within." Within actually means, literally means among. Among our land. God's already given them that land, even though they haven't taken possession of all of it yet. So if you're living among us, you're in our land, how are we going to make a covenant? How shall we make a covenant? They ask that question because God has forbidden it, hasn't he? Just like God forbids a lot of things today that our society does, we need to be very ready to close the door on something that is not good and wholesome, in spite of what our society is doing. Okay, so who did the Gibeonites say that they were? Verses 8 through 10. Eileen?
Okay. "But they said to Joshua, 'We are your servants.' And Joshua said to them, 'Who are you and where do you come from?' So they said to him, 'From a very far country.'" Oh, did you want me to read 9?
Yeah.
Okay. So
clear through 10, please.
Excuse me. "From a very far country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. Therefore..."
Thank you very much. All right. So who did the Gibeonites say they were? What's the first thing that they said they were?
Servants.
God, their servants. Yeah, we are your servants. And then they said they're from a far country, a very far country, they said. And because of the fame, literally, name of Jehovah your God, that's why they came. Of what he did. And then examples. So, the people around in all of the various nations, they've heard about the Israelites and about a lot of their history and what they've done. Even though it's been 40 years, they know that the Israelites came out of Egypt and that the Egyptian army all but perished and the Israelites escaped. And the Amorites and the kings of at Ashtaroth. A little praise and a little flattery is part of their deception, isn't it? So they're making their case. But what was their assignment? Question number 5, verses 11 through 15. Charlie, would you read 11 through 15 for us, please?
Verse 11. "So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go meet them and say to them, We are your servants, and now make a covenant with us.' This our bread was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. These wineskins, which were filled with new and behold, it was torn. And these clothes and our sandals were worn out because of the very long journey. And the men of Israel took some of their provisions, and did not ask for a counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them.
Thank you, Charlie. So what was their assignment?
So you got them to make a covenant.
What's that?
To get them to make a covenant.
Okay, thank you, yeah. To make a covenant with the Israelites. So they really sold it pretty hard, didn't they? To take possessions in your hands. They were to meet them, the Israelites, and say to them, "We are your servants. Make a covenant with us." So a thought just struck me. Usually when you send an envoy, or when one nation sends an envoy to talk to another and try to work out a deal of some kind, don't they take more than just their worn-out clothes and their own provisions? Don't they take a little something to sweeten the pot? Yeah, but they didn't do that, did they? They were playing the woe is me card. Look at us, we got worn out clothes, our bread's all crumbly, and it was warm. We took it right out of the oven the day we left. So that's part of the deception. The bread was warm from the oven, the wineskins were new, the clothes were new, sandals were new. Now they're all old because of a very, very long journey. What was Joshua's response?
He believed them.
He believed them, yeah. What was his mistake? He didn't counsel God, did he? Did not ask for the counsel, literally, the mouth of God, of Jehovah. He made peace with them. He made a covenant with them to let them live. The leaders swore an oath to them to let them live. So what should have Joshua done? Who should he have spoken to? Can Joshua necessarily speak directly to God like Moses did? If he can't, how does he communicate with God then?
Prayer.
Prayer, okay. Carol?
Well, that's how they chose who was the sinner, and they cast lots. So if he prayed to God and then cast lots to see whether God wanted him to accept this or not, God would have answered.
Okay, but who are we leaving out when we're thinking about how we speak to God?
Jesus.
The priests.
Oh,
Bill?
In 7th chapter after the defeat at Ai, it says, Jehovah said unto Joshua. He spoke directly with Joshua.
Okay. Duly noted. But there's another way that God also communicates to his people at this time. Remember, the priests have the Urim and the Thummim? Okay, so I don't know exactly how that works, but I know that that's one way that God communicated with his people, through the priests. So, duly noted though, Bill, about Joshua speaking directly with God. However that was. Numbers 27. What they should have done. What they did do was they took some of the provisions and they based their decision on physical appearances. Numbers chapter 27, verse 21. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire of him by the judgment of the Urim before Jehovah. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and his sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. So this particular context is the choosing of Joshua actually to succeed Moses in Numbers chapter 27. What they should not have done, Exodus 23. Verse 32. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods, referring to the Canaanite nation in the conquest of the land, is the particular conquest or context there. So they absolutely shall not make any covenants with them or with their gods. So this is a pretty big mistake on Joshua's part. They shall not live in your land. It says you shall make no covenant. The word make there actually or literally means cut. You shall cut no covenant with them or with their gods, and they shall not live in your land. All right, so how long was their deception successful? We find that in verse 16, because that's so short, I get to read it. And it came about at the end of 3 days that they made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. So it only took about 3 days for them to be found out. They found the truth after a 3 days journey. Well, let's see. They heard that they were neighbors. They heard that they were living within their land, which literally means among them. And I came up with the 6 days because they heard for 3 days, after 3 days, and then it took another 3 days for them to journey. We're going to find out here in just a little bit. To actually see them, see where they did live. So question number 7, how did the sons of Israel react to being duped? Sharon, would you please read us verses 17 and 18?
Did you say Sherry or Sharon?
I'm sorry, you.
Me, okay.
Grandma, please.
Yes. And the children of Israel journeyed and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon.
That's good.
Okay, thank you. So the children of Israel did not attack them because the rulers of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured against the rulers.
Okay, thank you. So, the whole congregation, your translation read murmured. The New American Standard, my Bible, reads grumbled against. Who did they grumble against?
Leaders.
They grumbled against their leaders. They didn't grumble against the Gibeonites. They grumbled against their leaders. Why did they grumble against their leaders?
The leaders had violated God's word.
Okay. And what's... So what? But so we made a mistake. What's the big deal? Hey, get over it. We'll just go wipe them out. They're a near neighbor, right? They lied to us. We are justified in going over there and killing every one of them. Right?
Nope.
Nope.
Having 1,000 armies, but in this particular case, they made a covenant, swore to it by God Almighty.
Okay.
And had they done anything like that, violate that oath, then they would have been sinning against God and breaking His covenant.
Indeed. Would you like to add to that, Dean, or he stepped all over
only
you?
Only to say that we get ourselves in the same kind of pickle today a lot of times. Number one, we don't take time. And I'm impressed Paul told Timothy, lay hands suddenly on no man, when he was talking about appointing elders. Sometimes you need to just slow down. If it's a good idea, it'll still be a good idea tomorrow. And then we make treaties. We enter into covenants or contracts. And sometime later, we wish we hadn't done it. But that's not a reason to invalidate the contract or invalidate the promise. People do it all the time. You know, you go into business with someone and you later find out that you wish that you hadn't gone into business with them and you hadn't signed a contract. But the fact of the matter is that you did sign the contract and you have to honor that contract. Yep. Even when it is to your hurt, you have to honor the contract.
Indeed, yeah.
And there are a lot of situations. I mean, I've gotten myself in those situations. And it's usually because I made a hasty decision.
Yeah, well, I've never done that. Bill? Did you have a comment, Bill?
Yeah, it's nice that you're perfect.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Right to heaven, Bob. It's a little strange here that on the one hand, they violated God's command to not make these covenants. And then they turned around and swore in His name to these people.
We're going to find out just here in just a little bit how important that ends up being, too. Because they had sworn by Jehovah, the God of Israel, they couldn't lay a hand on them. They're going to be faithful to God. They have to stand by the covenant that they made. So what did the leaders of Israel decide to do in question number 8? So verses 19 through 21. Bill, would you read that for us, please?
Me?
Yeah, you, Bill. I haven't asked you yet tonight, have I?
Yeah.
But all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by Jehovah, the God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. This we will do to them, and let them live, lest wrath be upon us, because of the oath which we swear unto them. And the princes said unto them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had spoken unto them.
Okay, thank you very much, and forgive me for abusing you and having you read twice. So what did they decide to do? Well, first off, they decided to let them live, didn't they? Why? Specifically, why did it say there? Right. Lest the wrath of God be upon us. So they became hewers of wood, drawers of water, their servants to do their bidding. So they got off pretty easy there, didn't they? So question number 9 asks, who told the Gibeonites, the leaders of Israel's decision? Diane, would you please read verses 22 and 23 for us?
And Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, why have you deceived us, saying, we are very far from you, and you are living within our land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God.
Thank you. So who told the Gibeonite leaders Israel's decision?
Joshua did.
Joshua did. He called them and spoke to them. He asked, "Why have you deceived us?" That sounds kind of like a rhetorical question to me. Well, duh, Joshua, we don't want to die. Joshua tells them, "You are cursed. You shall never cease being slaves. Hewers of wood, drawers of water, for the house of my God, Jehovah God." So they have their assignments. Question number 10. How did the Gibeonites know to fear the Israelites? So verses 24 and 25. Lenny, would you please read those for us?
So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore we fear greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us."
Okay, thank you. So how did the Gibeonites know to fear the Israelites? What does the text say there? Carol, you're bobbing your head.
They said that they knew that they were that their God had told them that they were supposed to destroy all the inhabitants. And they said, "We're sorry, we didn't want to die, basically. And it's in your hands now. We've done what we did. Now it's up to you."
Okay, well, that's true. But the phraseology was, "It was certainly told your servants." So, Joshua didn't tell them, did he? It's the old grapevine, isn't it? Word gets around. People talk. Just like today, people talk. That's Jehovah your God. They knew about Jehovah. They knew that Jehovah was their God. And that he commanded his servant Moses. So this isn't something that they heard just the other day. It's from a while ago. That your God gave you all the land. And to destroy all the inhabitants of the land. We fear greatly for our lives because of you, because of what your God has told you to do to us, to all those that are in Canaan land. So we can kind of figure that all the other nations around have heard too, haven't they?
Yeah, because they all gathered around to fight the Israelites. They all kind of, at the very first part of the chapter, the word got around. Somebody didn't die in one of these cities that everyone was supposed to be annihilated.
Or maybe somebody was watching from afar off and saw what happened.
But they had to have heard, right?
Yep.
They had to hear the message. So somehow it got out there.
Word of mouth. Yeah, word of mouth.
You know, being a servant is not always the best thing, and most of the time not back at that time probably. But when you think about it, whoever came up with their plan to do this, being a servant and having a life and being able to live still as a group of family or a group of people is still better than being annihilated by Israel. And so, for them it was a good plan if they determined that they would rather be servants than be slaughtered. So.
Typical human thinking, isn't it? Three hots and a cot sounds really, really good to a certain group of people out there. For instance, people who are incarcerated, a lot of times when they get out, they're not able to fit back into society very well. And rather than work really hard at it, they'll go out and commit another crime. Because it's more comfortable being taken care of, even in a penal institute, than to be out in society for them. There's a certain group of people that just can't seem to take care of themselves any other way. And, I mean, I don't think it'd be preferable back then, the prisons that they had then, but nowadays, about the only thing you lose in a jail is just being able to open the door and walk out. They have just about as many rights as the rest of us do. I'm not sure, but I think they can even vote now. No? If you're a felon, you can't vote, period. They're working on it, yeah. But they have televisions, they have food and warmth and clothes. So I haven't gotten to that point yet, and I hope none of the rest of us here do.
When you think about the rumor mill, okay, if they could do this as far as being deceptive, they could have sent spies into the land why the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness, or why they were traveling through, because they would still accept strangers. But Rahab had heard how great God was and how this land was not going to last. So whether it's from just standard understanding that God was giving this land and he was wiping people out, but whatever the reason was, they had 40 years of wandering to worry about those people who walked across the dry land out of Egypt.
Yeah.
And they've been worried about these people for 40 years. They've had their eyes on them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You always keep your eye out on your neighbor, don't you, Dean?
Well, I think she makes a really good point. Rahab did not become a slave. And these people became slaves. What was the difference? Rahab associated with the children of Israel because of a faith in God. And so she becomes as one of them. And, of course, we're familiar with how she is in the lineage of David. These folks did what they did out of just self-preservation. They had no intention of associating with God. They just did it for self-preservation. And they do preserve themselves, but they are not given the same position that Rahab held. So, we are not in the position of being the dominant force in our culture. I suppose in some places, I know that it's true in some places, that Christianity is the dominant force in a particular culture. And there are people that will associate with Christians just out of self-preservation, not as Rahab did, wanting to acknowledge their belief in God. And I see a big difference between those two people and between those two attitudes. It may look the same from the outside, but there's a big difference in what ultimately happens, and there's a difference in the way that they approach the whole situation.
Indeed, Rahab did have a saving faith, didn't she?
Yes.
And all these people that are living in Canaan land, they have a faith too. They believe God is a fearful thing. Only their faith results in fear, not in any saving grace for them. They just think, well, we'll all band together and we'll be okay because we can fight them if we all get together. Verse 25, "And now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us." That is complete capitulation, isn't it? That's like the surrender of Japan, 1945. Complete surrender. So, what did Joshua do to or with the Gibeonites.
They did just what they wanted. They said they'd be servants, so now they're servants.
They kept their end of the bargain, didn't they? Their end of the covenant. Thus he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel. And they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of Jehovah to this day in the place which he would choose. What was good and right in his sight? Well, what was good and right in Joshua's sight was to honor the agreement that he made, the covenant that was made with him. And the verse actually says that he delivered them from the sons of Israel, from the hands of the sons of Israel. So maybe the sons of Israel wanted to go ahead and kill them all anyway. But that didn't happen. I would like to read a short passage from 2 Kings chapter 21. No, 2 Samuel, excuse me. Second Samuel 21, verse 1 through 6. The heading on this particular passage is Gibeonite Revenge. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of Jehovah. And Jehovah said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the sons of Israel made a covenant with them. But Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of Jehovah?" Then the Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said, "I will do for you whatever you say." So they said to the king, "The man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before Jehovah in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of Jehovah." And the king said, "I will give them." So here, in the future from Joshua, Saul wants to exterminate some of the Gibeonites, maybe all of them. And he is held accountable for that. Israel is held accountable for that. All these many years later. So David takes action to remedy that. So I read that passage just to kind of focus on the importance of keeping an oath sworn before our God. It could be a little oath, it could be a great big one. But they're all the same in God's eyes. We should swear to our own hurt. If we swear to do something, we better do it. We better not try to renege on it, try to squirm out of it, try to say, "Oh, that was a long time ago," or, "Oh, it wasn't very important." Little things are important. Well, that's the lesson for tonight that I have. And if there's any further comment from anyone, I would welcome that. I'm not necessarily welcoming any questions, but... Bill?
The passage that you just read from Samuel, after the Gibeonites took and hanged Saul's family. What was the upshot of that? What, did it say anything right after that?
I didn't read on. I was just focusing on that particular part of the text. 2 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 6. Very well. The lesson is yours. And thank you so much for all your participation. I really do appreciate it.